Hey there, it's Dane Reinhardt bringing you the President's Perspective, a conversation between current and future leaders of NAHU.
This week, we're joined by our good friend, Bill Hepscher, who lives in, I will call it the broader Tampa Bay area, because I can never get all those towns right, even though I guess I really should, given how many times I've been there. Bill is, I guess you're, a year from being HUPAC chair?
That's right.
And then has been actively involved on the HUPAC side for a long time, but also has a very interesting business to us in the sense that they are focused on working on drug cost with employers and looking at reimportation options. And then the other thing that he does that fits right in with our business is that he owns a couple bars. So Bill's like the perfect NAHU member. So Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you for that, David. And you know, it's funny. I think I fit the mold of our typical NAHU member, right? Bar owner, drug guy, kind of like the rest of the membership, I'm sure.
So I know Danny and I talked about the nice thing about this is it's almost always to some degree a conversation about people who are in leadership positions and the relevant parts of what we do. But also, I think the great thing about what you do is it's also very interesting to me professionally because of how it fits in. I've got a couple of clients who actually use your affiliated company for some benefits. So once you kick it off, tell us how you got started and how you got lost on a highway one day and wound up at NAHU.
Yeah, I actually, unlike the two of you and unlike most folks that are, you know, NAHU members, didn't have any background in the benefits industry, didn't even have any background in the prescription drug industry. I got involved in the idea of lowering cost of prescriptions because my brother was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma when he was 27 years old. And that was about 20 years ago. And at the time, you might remember that that was the first that we were hearing about caravans of families driving, you know, from Minnesota into Manitoba to buy prescription drugs, buy insulins for their diabetic children. We were hearing stories about senior citizens in Michigan and New York who were driving over the border to Canada because they could buy their prescription drugs for so much less expensive. Well, my brother has his diagnosis and went through his treatment. He went through a bone marrow transplant. And I can tell you that the anti-rejection medications, even almost 20 years ago, cost about $500,000. So as a family, we were trying to find a way to obviously get my brother the medication he needed and, you know, not cause the family or him to go bankrupt at the time. And one of the ways that we found was that prescription drugs were so much less expensive in Canada. After experiencing that with my brother and coming back to Tampa and speaking to some of my physician friends, they told the story that, listen, Bill, we write prescriptions all day long, but that doesn't mean people are taking their prescription medications. Now, remember, this was prior to Medicare Part D. So what we discovered is that we could create the same type of model instead of somebody driving 10 minutes away from Detroit to Windsor. If you lived in Georgia or Florida or South Carolina, how could we get access to those same prescriptions in Canada? And that's when we created the Canadian Med Store, basically working mostly with senior citizens, having them order the exact same medications, the exact same manufacturers, but about 80% less expensive by sourcing them through Canadian pharmacies. And that's how we started our business 17 years ago now.
And I know it's grown. You have how many? You have a couple of retail locations. Is that right?
We do. We have seven what we call storefronts in the state of Florida. And when I say storefronts, let's not confuse that. We don't actually dispense any medications there. They'd probably be set up like any other, maybe an insurance office that somebody could walk into. They talk to one of our people face to face, and we walk them through the process. You have to remember that other than our group market, when we look at our individual side of the market, probably about 85% of our clients are senior citizens. So there's still a certain amount of comfort when they can sit across the table from somebody and actually talk about the process. When I started my company 17 years ago, the average senior wasn't walking around with a smartphone in their pocket. They weren't using Amazon. If you asked them about the internet, they might have said they had an AOL account and it was dial up and they only used it to upload the photos of the grandkids and it took 2 days to get the upload. You know, now the average senior is walking around with a smartphone in their pocket. They're using GoodRx. They're going to Amazon. But when they're talking about ordering an expensive drug from Canada, I think they want to have some type of a comfort level. So all of our clients still speak to one of our pharmacy techs and understand the process, whether they're doing that online, on the phone, or walking into one of our offices in Florida. But then we've expanded as well, and we work closely, David, as you know, with a lot of self-funded employer groups. So after the ACA came on board and we were working closely with a lot of agents and brokers through NAHU, we started to hear from agents that were moving into that self-funded world and saying, listen, if my senior clients that are on Medicare can do this, why can't my group that's looking at self-funding now do the exact same thing? And that's when we created our product that we call Global Rx Manage. And that's specifically designed to work with that employer market. So the same concept of the senior citizen going to Canada to buy a less expensive medicine, but we do it for the employer market. So the employer is obviously saving a bunch of money and we're keeping the employees compliant on the prescriptions that they need to take to stay healthy.
Yeah, I've got a couple of clients who are using Global Rx Management. And the great part for them is those employees who are otherwise getting the script actually have somebody to walk them through the process in the back end, and they're getting them by mail order. And again, it's not everything, but it's a lot of prescription drugs that really do significantly save the group money. And it's not really affecting how that person gets their meds. So if anything, it really has become a good fit for my couple clients and more that I think we're going to look at.
And David, thinking, you know, too, that we've talked about the 90-10 rule. You know, often it's that 10% of the population that are taking those expensive medications that's really blowing up the cost of the plan. So because we're not helping every single person, we're usually focusing on that 10% of the population that are taking the more expensive medication. So it has a real impact, not only on the prescription drug spend, but on the overall cost of the plan, because we can address those folks and keep them compliant on their prescriptions. So.
And you're not reaching the spec or ag, right?
In most cases, no. In a lot of cases, if it's built into, like, you know, the plan doc and we have a relationship with the stop loss carrier, you know, we can build that in. They can write that up. It's according to how the employer wants to handle that. What's going to be.
Yeah, I would think a lot of employers would just like to keep it outside the plan if they could, but it's interesting. You could go either way.
And what you go from is a drug that might produce $100,000 in claims now is more like $20,000 in claims. So the stop loss carriers for our groups have kind of liked it because they felt like it was a good fit for them and it was reducing their overall exposure.
I think they also recognize that those employers that are utilizing some outside the box concepts like ours are, they're looking to control costs. They're looking to provide quality healthcare, but to do it in ways that's actually going to cost less. So the stop loss carrier sees that as a positive thing, I believe.
Bill, I just keep listening to you and I want you to do a couple bars of The Gambler for us. Cause I mean, you really are pulling that Kenny Rogers thing off there today.
Well, you'll see. Maybe I'll do a little Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town. How's that sound?
I was thinking about when you and I first met was probably sometime in 2009. I think me, you, and Kelly Davis went to go see one of your legislators there. And we've been good friends ever since. And I know one of the areas you've been most involved in within NHU has been related to HUPAC. You want to talk a little bit about why that's a passion for you and what you've done about it?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I'll tell the story that I think every NAHU member has some story about how they got involved at the local board level or the state board level or ultimately at the national level. And my story is probably similar to a lot of people. There's kind of an ongoing joke in NAHU, you know, you leave the room and you become president. And that's kind of what happened to me, although it was a really positive experience. I actually joined the association, went to my first meeting and had volunteered to the president, hey, if you need help with anything, I'll be happy to help out. And I got a call the next night and she said, hey, would you be my HUPAC chair? And I said, sure, I'd love to be your HUPAC chair, but can you tell me, you know, what a HUPAC chair is and what HUPAC is? So she gave me a quick overview. And a couple of days later, I got an email inviting me to come to the Region 5 Leadership Conference in Orlando. And interestingly, I thought that it was a personal email to me inviting me to come to this leadership conference. I didn't realize that it went out to every single board member at every single local level. So I showed up there and I remember going around the room and everybody was introducing themselves. And I'd been with the association for 10 years and 14 years and this and that, and talking about how they served as president and vice president and membership chair. And it came around to me and I said, well, you know, my name is Bill Hepscher and I've been a member for just over a month. And I was asked to serve as HUPAC chair. And I don't think I'm supposed to be at this meeting, but I was embraced and I was made part of the group. And ever since then, I've been operating either as my local HUPAC chair or serving as Florida State HUPAC chair, served as Region 5 HUPAC chair. And I was honored when Eugene Starks called and asked if I would serve as his national HUPAC chair. And when you talk about why it's such a passion for me, I guess I've always been into the politics of things. largely because of my business, but because it's just something I enjoy and I'm passionate about. But I always say that if you go to a day on the Hill, at least in Florida, or if you go to a Capitol conference in DC, I think that we've made people lifetime members with those type of events more than anything else that we do as an association. Because I think that's where you really get the bug and you realize how much our association does for the industry. When you actually get to sit there and talk to legislators, when you see where those HUPAC dollars are going, you realize how much influence even a small association like us has on the industry and on policy having to do with healthcare. I think it just makes you feel proud to be a member. And I think it makes you realize how important that HUPAC contribution you make, how important it really is to our industry and our livelihood.
So for people that don't know your model extremely well, a natural question I think would be, well, how come every employer doesn't do this, or why doesn't every American do this? So a two-part question is, one, can you speak to the politics and sort of the legality? And I'm using air quotes when I say legality, because my understanding, it's a lot of don't ask, don't tell, and that there isn't any enforcement sort of some of the policies that are in place. And then secondly, we've heard a number of candidates talk about trying to use Medicare or the government as a buyer to do, in effect, what you're trying to get done, as I understand it, from Canada. So if you don't mind, could you speak to those?
I'll speak to the reason of why every single employer doesn't do it, maybe because, you know, we haven't done the best job as a company letting every single employer in the country know about us. I say that kind of jokingly. The real problem is there's obviously stakeholders on the other side that are charging Americans an awful lot for a prescription. So if the exact same drug is costing an American or a U.S. employer $1,000 and the same exact drug is being offered to the Canadians or the Brits or the Aussies for 80% less than that, there's obviously stakeholders that want to let folks believe that they can't get a prescription drug from an international pharmacy. I also think that it's interesting to know that, to your point that you said, you know, you believe that it's don't ask, don't tell. We don't believe that. We believe that the Medicare Modernization Act that specifically addressed purchasing prescription drugs from international pharmacies is legal, that the law actually says you can do that. And to follow up on that, subsequent guidance from the FDA and from Border and Customs has created specific guidance to say how you can go about doing that if you're driving over the border, for example, from Detroit to Windsor. They address the fact that you can't purchase controlled substances, that there's certain temperature controlled injectables that you can't source. And then they direct their own agents or compliance officers to say what should be allowed to take place. So I find it interesting that when people argue that it's illegal to do this, well, then why does the FDA, who's the agency in charge of it, have specific guidance telling people how to do it compliantly? It's pretty obviously that it is allowed to take place. I think what's interesting about the most recent conversation, specifically to President Trump's executive orders, and when you look to people like Governor DeSantis here in the state of Florida, obviously being a Floridian, we've worked very, very closely with HHS and with the governor's office and the speaker's office on this. But this is addressing kind of a different issue. We've always worked under the personal importation policy, saying that an individual can order up to a 90-day supply. What the new legislation and the new executive orders address is saying that states can purchase in bulk from a pharmacy distributor in Canada. So we've always argued that it's been completely legal for an individual to purchase a 90-day supply for personal use. The new legislation is addressing the ability for a state or a county or a school board to purchase in bulk from a distributor in Canada and then dispense those medications to their membership.
So in a hypothetical world, if this requires you to be politically tiptoeing or not, the drugs that are being brought in legally from Canada, if we as a country decided to adopt some of the models that the Canadians are doing, who are the people in the middle of that process that would be going to their lobbyists in DC speaking out against it? I assume it would be pharma, right? And there are others.
Yeah, it would certainly be pharma. And I have to tell you that being in this industry now for going on 20 years and talking to my counterparts, my partners in Canada and New Zealand and Australia and the UK, Dane, they will tell you that they will steer us away from a system exactly like theirs. As a matter of fact, to a person, they've told me that if they needed healthcare, if they had some type of a condition that they needed the treatment to save their life, they would want to be here in the United States to get that treatment. I think the juggling act that we do there is, can you afford those treatments once they're rendered? Ultimately, I would tell you from my political perspective, we have a business model built around helping people get lower cost prescription medications. And quite honestly, when I started my business 17 years ago, I didn't think we would still be here because I thought by now we would have addressed the cost of prescriptions and how it's just simply unaffordable, not only for individuals, but for employers. We just can't sustain this. But we're still here because the truth is most of the things we hear, even some of this talk about reimportation, in my opinion, and I've been very, very clear with this, you know, with my communications with the governor, is I think a lot of this is talking points. It's something to say, hey, listen, we know this probably won't really work on a large scale. We know that the Canadians don't have enough drugs to truly supply enough medications to America. But what I like about it is for the very first time, they're causing pharma to come to the table and justify why the exact same drug from the exact same manufacturer, often manufactured right here in the United States, costs us 80% more than it does the Canadians or the Brits or the Kiwis. It just doesn't make sense. And what pharma hates about it the most is that for the first time, we're looking behind the curtain and starting to ask questions about that. Would you please justify why it makes sense? I'm such a fan of what Governor DeSantis and what President Trump are doing in this situation. So whether or not we agree with a lot of the things that the president or the governor of Florida are doing on other parts, I can tell you that no one, no administration has challenged pharma like is currently taking place now. And I don't mean that from a political statement. I mean that from a standpoint of, for the very first time, pharma is having to justify why we're paying so much more here in the U.S.
I think this is the first one of our podcasts where I feel like we should pass a plate after the sermon. I feel like this is the point where I think we all get it. No, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that it's a necessary part of this conversation that we don't have. I've always appreciated your passion about it because at the end of the day, it's about trying to find the right price and to get us out of the situation where the rules have certainly caused Americans to pay more for drugs than we ought to. So I appreciate that piece very much. Wanted to close, at least talk a little bit about your side gig. And I know you recently moved, but you have what, two bars in the Clearwater, St. Pete area?
Yeah, I like to call them restaurants because my wife feels better about the fact that we own restaurants and not bars. But I think you've been to my establishments and they probably would qualify more as bars that serve food. Let's just say that, but really, really good food. So yeah, when I was in college, I worked in the bar business and I had a friend of mine, a partner actually in the pharmacy business. And there was an opportunity to buy a bar in St. Pete. And I told him, hey, listen, man, I made a promise to myself and my wife a long time ago that I was always going to sit on this side of the bar. I wasn't going to be on the other side anymore. And he ran the business model through me. And I said, hey, this sounds great. You know, and I think everyone's always wanted to own a bar. So we got involved in the business and it was very, very successful. And we opened our second location in Tampa across the bay. And our timing wasn't the best. We opened and 6 days later, after 18 months of build out, 6 days later, COVID hit and we were ordered to shut down. So, but now that Florida is open and going, we're obviously taking precautions, but we're successful. We're keeping the lights on. Proud to say that we never had to let any of our employees go. We were able to find ways to keep them all employed, whether it's the kitchen staff or the servers or the bartenders, you know, doing to-go stuff. And, you know, now seems like people are looking to get out and have a drink and have a burger and keep themselves socially distanced, but do it in a setting that is still fun and people can get a good meal. So,
Bill, thanks for coming on. I'll let Dane end us out.
Yeah, Bill, thanks. And thank you for being the last guest that we're having for this year. We're looking to increase the frequency of this podcast and be reaching out to you through social media, through NAHU. As I've said on other podcasts, you know where to reach me if you'd like to. Grateful for everyone that's active in the association and all that we serve. Happy holidays to everyone. And thank you very much, Bill, for joining us.
Thanks, Dane. Merry Christmas. Right, see you.